I spent 4 years at Queen's University, shouting in Gaelic at football games, waiting in line at the campus pub, and preparing for slide tests. I was an art history major. In between all the socializing, two ideas mentioned in passing during my painting seminars shot up like flares. The first one was this: men look at women, whereas women watch themselves being looked at. John Berger wrote this line in his must-read Penguin classic Ways of Seeing, and I've yet to find a more astute commentator on men's and women's different experiences with just being. These social differences, I woman, you man, so what's it all mean, were the most compelling reason I started this blog. I like trying to decode the sexes. Being a woman, I'm hyper self-aware the moment I step outside. People's reactions to me make my eyes and brain do 180 panorama shots of my surroundings. Sometimes I feel in control, other times I don't. The other night was not one of those times when I felt in control. I got off the streetcar well before my stop because a guy started owning me with his stare. I know the difference between an appreciative glance and a sinister stare. When I got on the car, this guy sitting at the back walked up the aisle and sat in the empty seat next to me and started leaning into me, boxing me in at the window. I waited about 10 seconds, which felt like an eternity, then rang the bell, got off, and heaved a sigh of relief when the streetcar took off with him still on it. Anthropologists study this sort of dynamic between lions and gazelles. You better hope the gazelle can run fast, because re-socializing all of the lions is complicated. Berger's ideas on looking came up during one of my university seminars on the artist Edgar Degas. We were looking at his ballet paintings. But when that statement came up, the prof wasn't showing us the artist paintings of ballerinas at the bar. You know, those colorful blurs of white tulle cinched by red and blue sashes that send museum gift shop managers into buying frenzies. Nuh-uh. We were looking at Degas' sooty oil sketches documenting the underbelly of the dance world, where men lurked backstage in order to watch and make their choice of rouged-up preteens before the girls burst onto center stage. This one came up, and if you go to the internet, put me on pause for a moment. Look for Edgar Degas' painting called Dancers Backstage. It's from 1872, and it's in the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. This basic dynamic where men look at women, whereas women watch themselves being looked at, isn't something that feminism has reversed or can necessarily correct. Women have a different social presence than men, says John Berger. Here's what he means. And now try applying this to all the powerful and charismatic men you know. This is what Berger wrote. He said, "A man's presence is dependent upon the promise of power which he embodies. If the promise is large and credible, his presence is striking. His promised power may be moral, economic, social, or sexual, but its object is always exterior to the man. A man's presence suggests that he's capable of doing A man's presence suggests what he is capable of doing to you or for you, even if he pretends to be capable of what he is not." And I think of Steve McQueen every time I read this. Do a Google image search on Steve and then apply this to that image. Berger went on to say, "By contrast, a woman's presence expresses her own attitude to herself and defines what can and cannot be done to her. Her presence is manifest in her gestures, voice, opinions, expressions, taste, and clothes." Should we protest this? Hell yeah, especially the what you wear and what can be done to you apart. The slut walk in downtown Toronto these past couple of years have been an attempt to re-socialize and educate the lions. But wow, what a never-ending battle we're facing. We're always two steps behind human nature's driving instincts. Berger goes on to say, "Presence for a woman is so intrinsic to her person that men tend to think of it as an almost physical emanation, a kind of heat or smell or aura." And here's where I'm going to paraphrase Berger. He says, "To be born a woman means existing within an allotted and confined space. The social presence of women has developed as a result of their ingenuity in living within such a limited space. But in doing so, women have had to split themselves in two. A woman must continually watch herself. She's almost continually accompanied by her own image of herself. If she's walking down the street, she can scarcely avoid envisaging herself walking down the street. Since childhood, she's been taught to survey herself continually. So it is any wonder that so many women are completely obsessed with body image, media pressures aside. Surely the most blatant example in the history of painting of this notion of men look at women while women watch themselves being looked at is a painting by Felix Trutat called Reclining Bacchante. So you can put me on pause here and do a Google image search. And the artist's name is spelt Felix, F-E-L-I-X, and Trutat is spelt T-R-U-T-A-T. And again, the name of the painting is Reclining Bacchante, B-A-C-C-A-N-T-E. The painting's from 1845, and what you're going to find when you hit on this image is a very young woman, probably in her teens, nude, reclining on a leopard skin rug on a bed next to a window, and in the window is a man, the face of a man, just glaring at her. Have a look. Now I want to move on to the second idea that made me think so hard when I was a university student. And it was this 19th century notion that women who read are dangerous. There's lots of paintings depicting this, and I'm going to get into a couple of those in a minute. But this idea that women who read are dangerous was well known as a rule of the 19th century in 19th century etiquette books. The thing about reading was that it made women unself-conscious and completely caught up in alternate realities. It made them forget their bodies and their place in the social order, all of which threatened to upend the desired domestic order. Women who sat and read books alone in public spaces, like park benches, became just as suspect in the 19th century as those who sat alone drinking absinthe in seedy bars. Reading and drinking came to be seen by men as a front for a pickup. Any woman who feigned interest in the written word was surely looking to go where angels feared to tread. Men took it as an invitation to hassle, make lewd comments, and proposition, while other women hissed their disapproval. Most readers had no choice but to seek out quiet, protected corners. And my favorite painting of this is a painting by Peter Ilsted. Ilsted is spelled I-L-S-T-E-D, and it's a beautiful painting called Interior with a Young Woman Reading from 1908. I think that painting will drive home the point that I've just made. So this discussion reminds me also of that famous photo of Marilyn Monroe from the late 1950s that shows her at a playground, sitting on a merry-go-round. She's in a swimsuit, and her head is bent over a copy of the novel Ulysses. When people first saw this picture, a lot of them have thought, oh yeah, right, as if she's really reading James Joyce or Dostoevsky. Well, Marilyn did. Others said, come on, what was she really doing on that merry-go-round? My guess is that she was waiting for the photo shoot to be over so she could get her check, go home, kick back, and actually read those novels. In public, at least, Marilyn Monroe's beauty canceled out the possibility she could ever be focused on anything other than herself. In other people's eyes, if she was out and about, she was courting attention. Marilyn, though, might not have seen it that way, especially when she covered her head in a kerchief, put sunglasses on, and tried to go about her life. It doesn't matter if Marilyn saw it another way. She was outnumbered. Sitting in the reading room of the campus library at my university back in the 90s, with a stack of seminar handouts to go through, I always sensed that while some opportunities had opened up for me and my friends, other forms of discrimination hadn't changed. Required readings often went out of focus for me the moment I acknowledged a stare from a jock sitting in the carrel over right beside me. That could be fun on a Friday afternoon when I was feeling carefree, but during midterms it was a different story. If the guy wouldn't let up, it was always up to me to move. Sometimes I headed straight for the stacks to avoid the stares. There in the basement, I could read, think, and drop down inside myself without being on display. Like most women, I wanted to control when and how I was looked at. That's still a tall order. It was while I was moving between the stacks and the reading room that I realized, but couldn't quite articulate at 19, that integrating the two sides of myself, the thinking side and the pleasure-seeking side, was going to be a challenge both for me and for the guys I liked. By graduation, I realized something else. It made no difference that women had been officially admitted to the library and to Queen's University in 1942. 5 decades later, beauty and knowledge still felt segregated. It made me think that feminism's strength was in opening up where women could go, but not in altering the signals we received once we got there.